Okay, so first of all, I would like to thank the organizer to invite me here and giving me the opportunity to present some of our work. It's quite exciting to show that to you. So the title of my talk is Pulse Quantum States of Light for Multimode. It's not quite working, but it's okay? Good. Still? Yeah. Somehow difficult to fix. Hopefully. It's good? Good. For multimode quantum system. So before I start to talk really about the general more detailed things, I'd like to start to pointing out some kind of vision we have. So the complete goal of all of the work I will be presenting is that we are setting out to construct somewhat more complex quantum system, and we want to do that in the photonic domain. If you think about that, if you want to produce photonic quantum states very easily, you want to have a system where the individual source is very simple, and you want to be able to build up systems of higher complexity, but you also want to ensure that you have a good means of multiplexing systems. So this is not working, though. No. Does anybody have a laser pointer? No. Okay. Anyway, so the pro. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Okay. So this is kind of what you see here is the hardware and the software part of our systems we're devising. So this is kind of the hardware part. We want to use integrated optics, and here you see that Chi2 or Chi3. This indicates how we generate our quantum states, and you've seen it already, a Chi2 nonlinear interaction can produce your quantum states via parametric down-conversion. One special thing we do, we always use pulsed light, and in fact, we're using ultra-fast laser pulses to pump our systems. And then we want to have several systems to interact. Thanks. Too late. Anyway. And one way to do that is in order to build up linear networks. Now, the question is, if I'm talking about quantum information, you will find in that community of photonic states two types of communities. So the one community, which is the older one, likes to talk about single photons, and here I detected one single photon with some pinion that beam split and it's getting split. And if you're talking about information in that context, you always have an encoding which is in some modal property. And I don't want to specify that more. This modal property could be polarization. It could be, like here, a photon traveling right or to the back. So it can be very different properties, but one very specific thing is that the information encoding is on the modal property. Here is the entangled state. And we assume that the quantum character in these states is intrinsic in the fact that you have single photon states. Now, there's another community which is somewhat smaller who always likes to talk about continuous, so-called continuous variable systems. What that is here you use the property of the quadrature, so it's more than wave-like properties, and it's related also to photon numbers. And you look at Heisenberg uncertainty relationships or on quadrature variances, and you encode your information more directly into these quadrature properties. Now, normally, we are not talking about modal properties in this system at all, but of course, if you look at the complete systems, in both of these systems, it's the same hardware. And basically, it's really both of them should contain, or description of them should contain both of it. And you will see in the following a little bit more what I mean by that. I will present you two of our research lines. So first of all, I want to go into detail how you really generate these quantum states with pulsed light. And I also want to show you a little bit what you can do then with linear networks. And here you were interested specifically how large can we devise systems and keep coherence. Now, if I'm talking about coherence, here we were interested, first of all, in classical coherence, but you will see how far you can go with that. So this is the outline of my talk. I will start out with explaining a little bit more what I mean by pulsed quantum states of light. I will show you how actually, if you understand that, can come up with a very interesting way of multiplexing information on these quantum states of pulsed light modes. And at the end, depending how much time there is, I want to show you some of our results of photonic quantum walks using these temporal states. Well, here it's still classical, which is a collaboration my group has with Igor Jek's group in Prague. So let's get started. Pulse quantum states of light. So if I'm talking about pulse states, I should start out with a classical definition, what is a pulse, and I think we are all very familiar with that. So if you're talking about pulsed light, we are talking of some state which has a finite time duration. Well, we know from classical optics very well, if you want to define systems with finite time duration, we need a spectral bandwidth. And here I depicted a typical way, it's a Gaussian wave packet with an envelope function, and here we have the timing in between. And this is the relationship, the classical relationship between frequency and time. It's nothing too special. Now, if you look at that, I can define my pulses just by defining the envelope function, and here I have the envelope function of a Gaussian beam. The interesting part is I can now define very different pulses. For example, I can take an envelope function, which is the first Hermite mode, or the second Hermite mode, and so on. Now, talking about Hermite modes, we know very well that these functions are orthogonal. So that means if I multiply those two together and take the integral over them, they're zero. Well, what that means in turn, it's nothing else. These are completely different modes. And this allows me, in the quantum picture, to define a quantum operator where here this hi is just a function, the envelope function, which defines in which mode you're in. So for example, here the red one is the first mode. Well, I use the Hermite mode, actually. It's a good measurement to define that. And I define this to the position of these modes. And the following, I can call these modes in the very same way in pulse modes as I normally would denote here monochromatic modes. They have the kind of the same properties. But now we're speaking about a different type of modes. While these are monochromatic modes, and we're used to them that they're completely separate, don't interact with that, here it looks a little bit more complicated, but in fact, mathematically, they're living on different Hilbert spaces, and they're yet exactly the same properties. So with this is kind of a very small introduction. I want to go a little bit more conventional, and I want to show you, introduce our system to start with. So as I told you already, the states we are generating, we use parametric down conversion. Well, just, I think we have seen that in a conference, but just to set the framework. We have a laser pump pulse. We pump a Ki2 medium. Because of the nonlinear interaction, well, one of the pump photons can decay in a pair of photons. Well, actually, here I'm a little bit more precise. Of course, what can also happen is that not only one pump photon decays in a pair of photons, but two photons and so on. The Hamiltonian describing that interaction is shown here. So it's just A dega B dega plus the Hermite conjugate. And if you write down the state which would result from that, it's a strictly photon number correlated state. And this lambda decays rapidly for higher photon numbers. So quite frequently you find the parametric down conversion only the first order, you say, one pair is generated. I will come back to that later on. Well, for the process in order to happen, energy and momentum conservation have to be obeyed. Something we also know very well, that means that the frequencies of the signal and the idler have to add up to the pump, and as well the k vectors of the signal and the idler have also to add up to the k vector of the pump. Well, one special thing we do in our lab is that we use for this parametric down conversion not regular bulk crystals, but in fact we're using waveguides. And I don't know if you can see it. So the crystal we have, so these are two microscope objectives, and this is, well, the piece where the waveguide is imprinted. So their systems are extremely small and compact, these sources. This is a PPKTP waveguide, and here is the scheme, which the idea which we have there. We pump it here with some blue strong light. And inside the waveguide crystal, we have a decay of one pump photon, the signal and idler photon. Well, in order for that process, just some technical details to happen, we have to obey phase matching. I told you already, the direction is fixed. But then, somehow, normally the velocities are not fixed in the same way. But what we can do a trick to achieve phase matching, which is not naturally given because signal and idler can travel at different speeds, we add some grading vector by changing the Ki2 nonlinearity and imposing some additional grading such that we can choose, at our will, where the sender frequency signal idler is. In this case, we used it for the first time back in 2004 when I was with Ian Wormsley in a group, in his group, where we used this process for the first time to have type 2 PDC in these waveguides, which got kind of convenient because then you can split it with a polarizing beam splitter. The point I want to focus at the moment, though, is I told you already that you have to have energy and momentum conservation. Well, if you look at this formula a little bit more into detail, so here I have written down the same thing, and this is your contour plot. So this is the frequency of the signal, this is the frequency of the idler, and in order for this property to be fulfilled, you have to have a minus 45 degree slope there, meaning you have a strict correlation between signal and idler photon. Well, we can width that. You see already that this has some width. This width is given because we have a pump pulse which also has some width. So we have lessened that constraint already a little bit. We also have momentum conservation. And this momentum conservation, I already mentioned that, is related to the fact that inside the crystal, different frequencies travel at different speed. And if because this is the case, this momentum conservation gives you a second contribution to this process in order to happen, which we call phase matching, and gives you another contribution, which is a correlation typically between signal and idler photon altogether. And if you ask what is kind of the joint spectral intensity of signal and photon altogether, it is the product of these contribution which comes from energy conservation and a second contribution which comes from phase matching or momentum conservation. And typically what you end up with is a system where you have quite a strict correlation between signal and idler photon. Okay, so that's all mathematical. You can believe that's the case. The question is, what does that mean? So how can we understand a system? So here I write down the state where we have create a signal and idler photon, but we have here this function, which is nothing else, but here we see the contour plot of it, which has some correlations in signal and idler. And actually, there's a quite intuitive picture how we can understand that. I don't want to go too much in the detail into the math, but normally what we say is, if you have this correlation, you can do a Schmidt decomposition, which means nothing else, but we define pulse modes, like I did here, and this Schmidt decomposition, we arrive at the situation where we say, yes, we are generating pairs of photons, and we generated them in different pulse modes. So if I have a Gaussian pulse mode here, I'm sure that also have a Gaussian pulse mode here, which also contains a photon. I can have the second meet mode, and you have a next mode, and this is also strictly correlated. So I can come up with a description where I say, actually, if I pump my crystal with a pulse system in this waveguide, I'm generating pairs of photons, but these photons are not only generated in one mode, but they're generated in a superposition of a lot of different modes. And what these modes are, these are exactly these pulse modes I introduced at the beginning. And if you look how we can simplify all that math and we write down our equations without any correlations, we simply write, this is the interaction of generating photons in the mode A and B, so this denotes these new modes. And we know every time if we have a photon in that one mode, we also have a photon in the other mode. So this is kind of the picture we have. And quite frequently, we are not happy to have a lot of these modes present simultaneously. But we actually would like to have a photon, what we call in a genuine single mode situation. So what we would like to have in quite a lot of situations is, if I have a Gaussian wave packet here, I want to have one Gaussian wave packet, not many of others of them, where actually, they have strict photon number correlation. They have strict photon number correlations, but no spectral correlations left. Well, we have learned over the last years how to do that, and normally you find that under, well, we call it source engineering. You could also know it as extended phase matching conditions. So what this is the following. You try to spectrally decouple the states, because if there's no spectral correlations between signal and idler present, then we really can describe signal and idler as Gaussian wave packets. One Gaussian wave packet here, Gaussian wave packet there, and nothing, no other modes present at that situation. We can't do anything about the correlations we have in the pump spectrum. This is energy conservation, and it just decays, and there's nothing we can modify there. But what we can do is we can access this phase match, this condition from the phase matching, which comes from this dispersion relationship and comes from the fact that different photons travel at different speeds. So this is directly related to the dispersion inside the crystal. And there are specific situations where you can make this contribution when this is an anticorrelation, a strict correlation. And, well, here in this example, the product of this is still anticorrelation, this is anticorrelation, the product will still need a correlated state. However, if there's a situation where this is a positive correlation, you can have a state where this is actually, well, doesn't have any correlation, so this is really the product of a signal wave packet which has a Gaussian form, and the idler wave packet which also has a Gaussian form. So this allows us, in a clever way, of using specific pulsed states for the pump pulse in combination with a very specific chosen material for the crystal to actually generate states which are spectrally decorrelated. So this is the spectral content. All what I've told you now about correlations and multimode character and all that applies in the same way also in the spatial domain. So normally if we have two different K vectors, there would be also strict correlations in that K vector frame, and you have a very complex system. But normally for a lot of, in order to get the system, the complexity of the system down, you want to have a little bit more control. Using a waveguide actually is good in that sense because you control the spatial degree of freedom very well. So you know already that if you use a waveguide, that the degrees of freedom in the spatial degree, in the spatial properties of this state are completely defined by the waveguide. And actually, you can get with waveguide sources very high brightness because of that fact. And you can also have very nice shapes in the spatial domain of degree of freedom, so that I don't want to talk about that anymore. But if you're interested, we have published two papers on that topic too. Okay, so we are all set. Now the question is, can we really do that? So is it possible to generate these very, well, specific states in a waveguide? And when is it possible? Actually, we calculated that and found out that it is possible by using a parallelly polled KTP waveguide chip and pumped that at 800 nanometer. Our calculation showed us that in this scenario, we really can have this positive slope for the frequency correlations, and thus we should be able to access these different frequency components. Now, what you wanted to measure in order to verify that theory is, first of all, you have to have a good measurement equipment which allows you to enable to measure very efficiently spectral correlations between signal and idler photons. Well, working in with single photons, you probably know setting up spectrometer and trying to measure then correlations between different spectral components is not a nice thing. So it's you need high efficiency. It's really quite complicated. So we built a kind of special spectrometer here for that purpose. So here you see a scheme of our setup. We pumped our crystal, our waveguide, where we generate our signal and idler pulses. Well, we split them off at the end. Here we expected our signal and idler pulses where we wanted to measure the spectral correlations between them. And then we used a dispersion compensating fiber. And we launched just the complete state into that. What that fiber does for you, it creates a time-to-frequency correlation. So the blue frequency part is traveling the slowest in this fiber, while the red frequency part is traveling much faster. So basically, with that, we could afterwards split signal and idler photons directly with the polarizing beam splitter and launch into APTs, and we compared a clock, which was given by the trigger time, to the arrival time of the photons in these two polarizations. These arrival times directly. So we've got a diagram like that. So you get arrival times of the signal, arrival times of the idler, and you get some curve. And because you know what that dispersion of fiber is, you can do a wavelength calibration and can measure very efficiently directly the spectral correlation functions. Just as a reminder, I know that this is sometimes quite confusing. So this is the same thing I told you already by source engineering again. So the energy conservation gives you that minus 45 slope. The momentum conservation in our system was set such that you had a positive correlation. This is crucial because only then, if you have this positive correlation between signal and idler given by momentum conservation, you really have a good handle to change these correlations in characteristics. So in this situation, you would still have here, you would have some negative frequency correlation. Well, if you adapt now the pump width correctly, such that these two match, you can achieve the situation where you have no correlation whatsoever. If you choose to have it very narrow band, the pump, you would have still negative correlations. If you have it very broad, like here, you would have positive correlations. Well, this is the experimental result. So this is our system pumped. So this is the spectrum of the pump. So if you pump it with very narrow content, what you receive out of that, or what you get, is here signal and idle wavelength. So these are measurement data. So you see that you get here very nicely that negative correlation defined basically by the energy conservation of the pump. You increase the pump bandwidth, and if you match the pump bandwidth correctly to the phase matching condition, you get here this circular shape, which corresponds to the situation that you really have two pulses just. And if you then broaden your pump up even more, you get positive correlation. Now, I told you that this should correspond to single mode and multi-mode situation, to these different intermediate modes. And the question is that just a mathematical tool, or is there really some physics behind there? Because it looks very mathematical. So you have a correlation function, you decompose that, and then you define these strange pulse widths. The question, can you really physically access them? And so that actually you can do that. And for that, I have to go a little bit more into detail how we did that. And I have to actually use the fact that we know the Hamiltonian of our interaction, and specifically that we know the photon statistics of these interactions. So I told you that the Hamiltonian is such that we had that A dagger, B dagger. This is true for one mode. So if you have only one mode present, we are generating in the system this photon number correlated state, but we are generating them with very characteristic photon number distribution. Basically, this is the photon number distribution of a two-mode squeezer. Here, you see that we have this lambda. So if you just look at one arm and cross the other one, you have that lambda over n dependence. So we have an exponential decay of the photon number contribution. And this is nothing else if you trace over one of the arm like a thermal state. And from the thermal state, we also know that correlation functions can measure them quite nicely. So basically, single mode characteristic corresponds to thermal photon statistics, a completely different measurement, and it corresponds to G2 values of 2. Maybe I should say what a G2 value is. A G2 is just the correlation function, which you typically measure by putting your line on a 50-50 beam splitter. We call the coincidence clicks you get from that, and you just divide them by the single clicks. It's the Glauber correlation function. They are well known in quantum optics. If you're in the situation of a highly multimode system, this is indicated here, these multimodes, these are the intermediate modes, every individual has the same form and has also these thermal statistics. But if you have a convolution of a lot of statistics, and this is Gaussian central limit theorem, you will always end up as Poissonian statistics. You can't help that. That's just a convolution of a lot of different thermal statistics gives you Poissonian statistics. And basically, in this situation, the multimodeness is characterized by G2 value of 1. If you didn't understand that, the only take-home message is from measuring a property which is related to photon statistics, you could access is the system multimode or single mode. And here, what we see again, here this is the width of the spectrum, and here it's A, B, C corresponds to the situation we had here. So A is the situation where we have negative correlation, C positive correlation, B is a system where we had no correlation. And this is the expected G2 value in one arm for different pumps, spectral pump widths. You see the measurement data here are these red points, and you see that the quantitative behavior, was very well. So we really got at the point B a G2 value which was the highest, and this calculation from the spectral content was fitting. There's an offset in there. We know that this is a technical problem with background counts. So, but we could characterize them very nicely and ended up with the blue curve, and we're pretty confident that we know what we have. So that did prove for us that we're actually able to generate single mode squeezed light in the sense that we really have only two pulses present. And for those of you who are familiar with that, we then went further and wanted to ask how bright is that source? Because brightness is in these things always a very important quantity. So what you see here, we only looked again at one of the arms, and we changed the pump power of our system, and this is the mean photon number per pulse. And what you see here, we had a mean photon number with only 60 picowatt average power. We had a mean photon number of 2.5. It's extremely high. So if you ask, what is the highest repetition rate of generating photons? Well, it's only limited by the repetition rate of a laser. We have to crank down the power quite a bit in order to avoid multi-photon contributions. This is a negative way of phrasing it. You could also say we have a single pulse configuration where we have a system which can generate highly squeezed states. So if you calculate what 2.5 means, it would correspond to 11 dB of two-mode squeezing. If you're skeptical about losses, well, this measurement also tells us, and I can go into detail if you're interested, that we shouldn't have too many losses in the system. That looked promising. So what I showed you up to now is that we have complete control of the mode structure of these of pulsed multimode systems, of pulsed systems with quantum states. And the question you might ask, is that useful for anything? So we can play around. I think it's fascinating that we really can now generate quantum states in the femtosecond duration. But is it useful that we have all these different pulse modes present? And actually, one idea which you might come across quite quickly, I told you we have several modes present there, and we can control how many modes we do have, is that you ask, can we do multiplexing? Like, so can we encode information on every individual of them, which would mean we have a system which is very much constrained in time, because all these modes, these temporal modes, are on top of each other. But nevertheless, we have an Hilbert space which can be quite large. So basically, the ideas we have here, Alice and Bob, like usual, and we have systems where on top of each other, all these modes are on top of each other, and we encode the information in them. It's ideal because it's already adapted to the state generation process. I showed you we have the sources for them, and it's kind of the natural basis which arises from the parametric down conversion sources anyway. One problem you immediately recognize is if you have these modes, somehow if you do information encoding of that, you have to spatially separate them out. Otherwise, they are present, but how does that help? And the easiest way you might think of is put them through filters, spectral filters. Well, you can analyze what's happening if you put a spectral filter on these modes, and I can tell you it's getting a mess. So basically, spectral filtering in this situation doesn't do for good, and it's quite easy to see why that is. If you ask what is the intensity, well, if I have some small slice here, of course all of these modes have some contributions of in this region. So this is spectral filtering, although we believe that it's always increasing the purity. If you really look at the complete state, it's getting really complicated. So we thought if you really take that serious and want to use that as a new information carrier in a system where we can encode information, somehow we have to come up with a system which allows us to work on these modes individually. And this is why we came up with the concept of a quantum pulse gate. So what we want is the following. We have Alice, and she has encoded the information on these states. And somehow we want to have a device where we dial up here a mode we want to access. And then this mode should get split and all the others should get transmitted. We want to be able to dial up a different mode shape, and this should be then split out, and the other get transmitted, and so on. The question is that possible? And for a long time, I think we were also struggling. We thought it's not possible at all, because if you look into that, you kind of have to redistribute energies. But then there's one process which we found out which can be useful for gating anyway, and it's used in classical optics quite a lot, which is some frequency generation. So let's have a look at the process of some frequency generation. The some frequency generation Hamiltonian looks like the following. So it's a linear Hamiltonian in A in, the input mode, and C out. This is the mode which gets converted. So if this photon is an input photon and it has some frequency, this output photon, it corresponds to an output photon which is at a different frequency. This Hamiltonian is a linear operation with some coupling constant theta, which depends on the pump power, on the nonlinear material, and so on. However, formally you find that this is very much analogous to beam splitter. but it's a very strange Beamsteader. So this is, I just wrote you for comparison, the standard Beamsteader equation we normally use here, where A and C, in this case, are just spatial modes. If I'm talking about this some frequency generation as a Beamsteader, these are not spatial modes. This is the mode at some frequency, let's say at 1500, the other one is a frequency at 800, and they are combining. But otherwise, we have complete analogy. So if you ask, if you look in the some frequency generation process and ask what it's really doing, well, if you analyze the broadband, because remember, this was the concept, we wanted to have one pulse, so we want to operate the some frequency generation with pulses again. It's again a mess in a similar way like the parametric down-conversion source. If you just put a normal parametric down-conversion source, you have the spectral correlations. Here you also, in the sum frequency generation, you have the same spectral correlations, and it's hard to see what's going on. However, we can use the same source engineering tricks for sum frequency generation, then we use the parametric down-conversion. So we can start to think what is happening, what is the unengineered, so if what's happening is the try to decompose this correlation function, which is written here, again into broadband modes such that the frequency degrees of freedom decouple. And then you find a quite interesting structure, because it tells you every sum frequency generation is nothing else but a set of different Beamsteader operations. And the ratio of this coupling theta of these just depends on the input power. So I can tune my Beamsteader ratio from 0 to 1, depending how much power I launch into that. What you also can do then is, if you look for the conditions, is you can engineer the sum frequency generation. And specifically, you can use it just that you get, again, a decorrelated phase matching condition. This happens if the group velocities of the signal and the pump photon travel at the same speed. And you can eliminate all these other contributions in the same way we generated only in one photon pair this situation, and you really can pick out only one mode, and the others will get unaffected if you choose the coupling ratio to one. And that some frequency generation can be very efficient. We know that from other experiments, it has been used to transfer quantum states from one frequency to the other. And moreover, here you see the input frequency and the output frequency, and here you see different shapes for these characteristics, and these are given by the pump of the sum frequency generation. So the message I want to take to give you here is, yes, sum frequency generation is capable of sorting out different frequency modes and gives us the possibility to actually select them out spatially and do information encoding on that. I think that's quite a nice perspective, because that means we can use them for higher dimensional information encoding, and moreover, if you want to do some non-Gaussian operation or things like that, use this device and then you can do all kinds of things. Just I don't have the time. You might be still skeptical and say, well, does that really help? So is that really increasing your information capacity? Because after all, if you know a little bit that, you can also calculate the channel capacities of highly squeezed states. The answer, the short answer is yes, it does help. If you analyze a multi-mode system in comparison to a single-mode system, do a fair comparison, you can find that these multi-mode systems are really capable of transmitting more quantum information than classical information, provided you have squeezing over some thresholds. But I don't want to go into details there. So how much time? Okay. With that, I would like to come to my last topic, which is, well, changing a little bit the topic anyway, but still being related to pulsed quantum states of light, at least to pulsed light, which is photonic quantum walk. So just another introductory slide. What is a quantum walk? I think many of you are familiar, and we have thought already almost something about that. The idea is simply a classical walk is just, well, a Dalton port where you have a ball falling down, and if you collect the statistics from different balls, you would get a binomial distribution. If you replace these posts here by Beamsteaders and look for superpositions, you get something very different, which is typically considered as a quantum effect in this system, or at least as a coherent effect, which is just because the ball, a single photon, could go left and right simultaneously, and then we get very different statistics. This kind of quantum box systems has been studied, well, quite intensively from the theoretical side, and one might consider them as a toy model for all kinds of other systems, like solid-state physics systems, quantum information might be interesting in biophysical systems. They're really toy models, showing you, you can learn a lot what coherence means by that. So the system I'm talking to be a bit, little bit more concrete, here we have an input state, which is divided in beamsplits all the time, and here we get interferences. The evolution, which if you really want to know how that really looks like, is the quantum state is always coupled to its neighbors. These coupling constants are, well, you can define them either here by the beam splitting ranges, or in general, this is just given by a coin state, which you set there. You can define a second Hilbert space, like a polarization state, and they can be different. But nevertheless, if you ask what the output of such a system would be for a single photon, well, here I plotted that. It's a massive interferometer. It's pretty clear that this system will not just give a binomial distribution. And what's nice about that is you can study in such a higher dimensional system coherence properties, but just asking what's happening if I'm introducing in these paths here different decoherence mechanisms. So it's a very simple model, but at least shows you already for classical systems what decoherence can do. The question is, how do we implement that? Well, we came back using an idea which, well, it's time multiplexing, which we originally devised for implementing a photon number resolving detector, which corresponds to the beam cascade shown here. The problem is with that system we originally had, there's no interference between the paths, but we needed to have a system like that. We want to have a highly complex system where here we require phase stabilities between all the systems. There are other ways to do that, I should say, and more people have been starting to try to implement such systems in various ways. Well, Andrew White's group is very active in that. Silverback's group did that for classical optics, and Jeremy O'Brien's group did that for quantum states up to now. The systems we have been using is the one which implements a discrete quantum walk. So these others are so-called continuous time quantum walks. And we use pulses for that combination with time multiplexing. So just to introduce the system very briefly, you have your quantum state encoding on a pulse. And this encoding, it is a pulse, but it has also an internal degree of freedom, in our sense, of polarization. Now, if we start in our system from the beginning, this is a polarization. We have half-wave state, which can be tuned. And then we have that system, which we call stepper, which is basically an interferometer with different arm lengths, but these are polarizing beam splitters. So if a pulse comes in, what's happening is it gets split, and the two polarizations get split from each other. Now this system we feed back again in the next step. What you see, well, we get this spinning gain, but because we switch the polarization here, the two inner parts interfere. And you can run that system over and over again. And the nice thing is because it's a loop, so here you see the system how it's in practice, so we have a loop, here we have these different fibers. The system's extremely stable. So we tested that with coherent light, and what you see is that this is a pattern which is corresponds to a quantum walk after 28 steps. And if you want to implement that system really in a spatial degree of freedom, that would correspond to 46 beam splits and 29 detectors. So that tells us that we can really control also optical systems for a quite complex system. So once we had that, we were quite happy because this is already a system which is quite large. And I told you that you can study decoherence properties. So how could we do that? But the way we did that is one element I haven't introduced here, which is an electro-optical modulator. What that does is nothing else, but we can switch from pulse to pulse its polarization and modify that slightly, and we can program that. So we implemented that system where we have this electro-optical modulator, and we wanted to study what static and dynamic disorder can do to our system. So what do you expect? So maybe I should explain how static and dynamic disorder is characterized in these systems. That dynamic disorder is simply if you completely randomize these polarization degree of freedom, this corresponds to a complete randomization of phases. What you expect in this situation is that you go from your quantum walk, which had these pronounced outer wings, to a system which is just a binomial distribution. and this is shown here. So this is experimental data. So actually, by introducing in our system just completely randomly some phases, we ended up the situation that we really had a nice phenomenal system. We can also introduce a simulated static disorder. We do that simply that we introduce a position-dependent phase. So in every step, if you're coming to the same position, we have the same phase. However, if we we still randomized it over different places. And this static disorder is known as an Anderson localization effect. So we know that we should get some very different results. And actually, this is also experimental data. And you see that for that static disorder, so if you have a position-dependent phase introduced, you get very pronounced peak with a characteristic of the Anderson localization that if you plot it on the log scale, that you get a linear dependence. So this is a very clean experiment where we can really introduce peak coherence mechanisms in the way we want to do that. And here you can see, so these plots are here at the end where we have flat distribution. But of course, we can also, since we program these phases we want to have, we can start with here at that point. We haven't, so this is a plot where this is the variance of the phases we have introduced, and this is the spread of the random walk, so just the variance there. And we can go where we can program different phases, and here again, we see the characteristics of Anderson localization effect. This is the variance of a classical distribution, you see the variance of this Anderson walk, Anderson localization effect is actually smaller than you would have it for the classical situation. With that, I'm coming to the end. I summarize. I showed you what mean by pulse quantum state of light, single mode and multimode. I hope I convinced you that it's a fascinating possibility to achieve a different information encoding. And at least very briefly, if you have questions, please ask me. I can go into detail there. How quantum work systems. That I would like to thank you for the attention, but I also would like to point out that, of course, the work was not all done by me. The pulsed systems, the PhD student is Andreas Eckstein, together with Andreas Christ and Taylor Mosley. The multiplexing right now, the PhD student who is responsible for that now is Benjamin Precht. He took over from Andreas Eckstein. And Andy Christ is also involved. Last but not least, the quantum walk experiments are mostly carried out by Andreas Schreiber and Katricia Casimir together with Peter Rodis.